This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 100, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. My mission here at the Alien UFO Podcast is to investigate all things that are part of the wider UFO phenomena. I'm looking at UFO sightings, alien abduction, historic cases, and other related events. And so I've hit 100 episodes, and I just want to say thanks to everyone who listens to the podcast for supporting me and listening every week. And every Thursday, I'm going to be releasing episodes called UFO Encounters, so please check those out. And if you want to hear the extended version of this interview, you'll need to join the Patreon campaign, where there are now more than 90 episodes in the back catalogue. For $5 a month, you get an extended episode every week, and for $2 a month, you get an extended episode every month. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe. This week, I'm talking to Mark Olley about his book, Europe's Roswell, 40 Years Since Impact. Mark is an internationally recognised author, TV producer, presenter, writer, lecturer, broadcaster, musician and artist. He is a visiting lecturer at Wilmslow Guild and the University of Chester. He heads up his own archaeological unit and runs a DVD production and props company, Mythco. Well, hi Mark, thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Thank you very much for inviting me on.
We're going to talk about your book. It's called Europe's Roswell, 40 Years Since Impact. But first of all, can you tell us about the experience you had? Was it in 1976?
Yes, it would be the hot summer of 76. Well, that was quite interesting. Not going into too much detail, but it was the hottest summer we had in the UK, I think probably on record. Anybody that was alive then will remember it. It was just crazy. And I went out camping with some friends and we were in a position where when it came to the evening, we couldn't actually put the tent up because where I live, the ground's very clay, has a high clay content, and it had basically baked. So we tried to put the tent up. We couldn't do it. So, you know, it was so warm at night. It was Mediterranean almost. So we slept on top of the tent as a ground sheet, just on sleeping bags. Anyway, something woke me up in the middle of the night. I seem to recall it was a fox. And the other two lads were asleep. And I'm looking up at the sky and I'm just thinking, wow, this is amazing. You know, I was 14 at the time. I don't think I'd ever seen stars quite like it because there was no light pollution where we were, which was good. No satellites, no jets flying overhead, none of that nonsense. And then I noticed this star moving across the sky. And I'm thinking, oh, that's a bit odd. You know, maybe it's a helicopter, maybe it's a high-flying plane, because that was about the only options you had back then. But it was moving, it was about the same size as a bright star, and it was just moving in a straight line very slowly across the sky. So I watched this thing for a minute or so, and it kind of came till it was almost level overhead. And all of a sudden, it just went ping, 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 back and to, from one side of the sky to the other. And then it kind of came back to where it was in the middle of the sky, and then just disappeared. And I'm looking at the sky and I'm thinking, what on earth was that? I've never seen anything move like that ever. Anyway, of course, following day, I told my friends, and my friends are like, nah, you're making it. It must have been a shooting star. What a load of nonsense, you know. So that was the first real encounter that I'd had with something flying that was way out of my ability to explain. Really no idea at all what that was.
What was happening in 1976 seems almost as though it was putting on a display for you, because it's something that I think about, and I've said this before in episodes, it's like it could have done that without having lights on, without lighting itself up, but it wanted to be seen. Did it seem like that?
Now you mention it, I mean, that's a keen observation. Nobody else has actually said that yet. So, yes, it could have been. A couple of things actually feed into that. Why on earth would it be heading towards me anyway? Because it started on the horizon and it was, you know, absolutely 12 o'clock right in front of me, heading straight through the sky over the top. So that's the first question. The second question would be, how did it know when to do this ping pong thing? Because it did it when it was immediately above me. There was no doubt it was directly above me. And it did this ping pong thing and then vanished. So I'd never really thought there was any kind of air to ground link, if you like. You know, my awareness of it was obvious, but its awareness of me. I'd never given that any thought. That's a really good question. I'm going to go with there's a high possibility that that could be the case. That you know, there was nothing else there. I mean, we were in the middle of, I don't know, 6 or 8 square miles of open fields, just broken up by the odd woodland. And the average person would just be asleep, you know, in the beds in a house somewhere. And to be honest with you, it wasn't a proper campsite. You know, we just got permission off the farmer to park up in the corner of his field with this tent. So there was no real reason for it to be there doing what it did. So, yeah, that's a very good point.
Because there are people who say that they've been abducted by aliens. They always talk about telepathy happening and consciousness getting involved. So maybe they were able to connect with you in some way.
I'm willing to concede that they possibly did know that we were there. They were incredibly high up, though. I mean, whatever it was, you know, was literally a bright, you know, pinprick of light in the sky. So they were way off. And I've not had any other unique to me encounters since then. Because the point of the next encounter I had was that more people had seen it than just me. I was part of a much bigger picture on the next encounter that's in the book. So fantastic question. Yeah.
Okay. So the next one was, you call it the South Wirral Lights?
It's actually known as the South Wirral Lights. I didn't realise that was the case. I'll give you the background because the story's quite interesting. Early 1980s, I think I'm right in saying it would be, what did I put in the book? I think it was 81 or 82. So you're into the 1980s, 1981. I was up on top of a hill, a local hill. We've got this high spot at the back of where I live here that is quite high, significantly high. And you can get on top of that. And I'd come back after doing a late night recording session, because I was in the music business as a drummer, as a session player, and we'd finished extremely late. So I came up to this hill and I'm just kind of, you know, winding down, sat on the hill, watching all the twinkling lights, broken cloud. You could see stars. It was quite a clear night. But way off towards, because I live between Liverpool and Manchester, I'm almost in the middle of Liverpool and Manchester. You could see right down the whole of the Mersey Valley from this high point. And as you sort of go out of the Mersey towards Liverpool, there's this thing called Fiddler's Ferry Power Station down there. There's 8 towers and it used to pump out steam, you know, 24/7. It's coal-fired power station. Anyway, I'm looking down in that general direction and all of a sudden the steam on one of these towers just kind of lit up. So you've got sort of white light and then the odd flash of blue and the odd flash of red. And then this thing comes through. Now, at that distance, because, I mean, it's going to be the best part of sort of 8 or 10 miles away. At that distance, it could have been a helicopter. But it struck me as being odd because helicopters generally don't fly immediately over the top of coal-powered power stations. They don't. Yeah, the steam's coming out at 40 degrees, which is about the same temperature as a kettle. So, you know, you'd be sort of lightly boiled, lightly toasted if you flew through that. So I kind of watched this thing come through and I'm thinking, what on earth is that? You know, is it lost? Is it an aeroplane? Anyway, it comes toodling up the River Mersey and it's got all these little lights going underneath. It's mostly white lights, but occasionally they're a bit like the modern day theatrical lights. So it'll be white 1 minute, then in a flash, it'll go blue. And then one of the other lights in a flash will go red, and then it'll go blue again, and then white. And then, you know, so they're changing colors. And it looks a bit like the scout ship out of Close Encounters of the Third Kind, the little tiny ship that you first see in that film. From a distance, it kind of looks a bit like that. So it follows the north bank of the River Mersey till it gets to Warrington, till it gets to Bridgefoot. And that's probably the most uninhabited part, really, of the whole area. And when it gets to Bridgefoot, which is Warrington, you could see the lights of the town behind it. All the lights on this vehicle go off. And you could see something about the size of a 7.5-ton truck, kind of this shape, just disappear at hugely fast speed up into the sky, literally just goes whoosh. So I'm like, good grief, what on earth was that? Anyway, I made a note of it in my diary. So this is where it starts to get interesting. 11 years later, there's a book published called Mysteries of the Mersey Valley. And on the cover, lo and behold, is a flying saucer with a white floodlight coming down onto the River Mersey. And I'm thinking, I wonder if somebody's seen the same thing I've seen. So anyway, I bought the book, Sigma Leisure it is, Jenny Randall's and a partner who was called Huff, I think. Anyway, they'd written this book and they put a couple of other accounts in the book. And blow me, it's the same date. You know what I mean? It was the 12th of April, 1981. And it's, again, around about the same time. I estimated it was about, you know, 2 o'clock, half past two, something like that. That is exactly when it was. It was half past two when I saw this thing. Anyway, it turns out there's a plane going into Liverpool Airport that reports flying over something that was airborne. When they looked down, when the people looked down, they could see this thing that looked like a light bulb. They described it like one of these sort of opaque, orange, old-fashioned style light bulbs. And they looked down, they could see this thing, which, when the plane then disappeared, this thing apparently took off then, and it flew across the Wirral. Now, there was a couple of other folks camping up there on the Wirral this night. They saw it, but they perceived it as a sort of a yellow white light hovering over a factory, which then suddenly took off, went brighter, and then started changing colour. So they described this red and blue thing going on. And then apparently it flew up the Mersey, and when what they saw was it disappear into the steam from the power station. So lo and behold, I saw this thing then come through that and carry on to Warrington. And that's in there. It's known as the South Wirral Lights. I think it's in that book as the South Wirral Lights. And when you actually plot that on a map, it looks like it's going in a straight line. It's a straight line of about sort of 14 miles west to east. And it follows perfectly right the way through to when it turned its lights off and disappeared. But the thing there is it took 39 years for me to stitch all that together. So it came out in one of Philip's books, Encounters Up Close and Personal, UFOs, Jason Gleaves. Philip put my account where I'd linked it all together. He put it into that book in 2020. So what I've done is I've updated it, and that's my second encounter. But I wasn't alone. You know, it wasn't just me. There's a couple of guys camping on the Wirral. There's a couple of guys flying an aeroplane, looked down and spotted it. And then I'm if you like, the last witness. But it had already gone into print. You know, so that was my other kind of UFO wake-up call, if you like.
And it's great because it's multiple witnesses, which is always a good thing in these sorts of, you know, paranormal and what have you, because it's almost always just a single person sees something and the skeptics come in and say, well, you know, one person, maybe their eyesight's not so good, they don't quite work out what they're looking at.
Well, it was Jenny Randalls and Peter Huff that actually linked all three accounts together, because they discovered this account of the aircraft spotting it. And then separate from that, they also found these guys who were camping who'd seen it as well. And then it's me, 11 years later, I buy the book and then eventually get around to linking it all together. And all the times add up, all the directions add up, you know, clearly what happened physically happened. There's no doubt about it. The evidence for that is overwhelming over such a long period of time. But like you say, nothing airy-fairy about it. Very, very solid. And really, that's when my attention, you know, on UFOs really sort of picked up. In fact, you can't ask me a question about the next bit. I can tell you a couple of other bits and bobs as well. Because my interest, you know, it does stem out of my dad also being interested. He had Flying Saucers Have Landed, the Adamski and Leslie book. He had that. So I'd read that as a teenager. So that had kind of got my interest. But then that was sort of before I saw anything. And then after I'd seen this UFO, which is in the 1980s, when I came out of the music business in the 1990s, I floated back into archaeology again. So I kind of ran my own archaeology unit. And I can vividly remember one occasion when we were on site, because of course we're camping and we're in the open air, you know, we're under the skies and doing what we do. And one of the ladies on the dig came running in and went, "Oh, we've just been buzzed by a flying saucer." I'm like, what do you mean? So I didn't see it. But when I went out, there's quite a few of them. They're all stood around looking up in the sky. And she said, "Oh, this big disc that was lit up." She said, "It kind of dive bombed us." She said, "It kind of came over the top of the site at high speed and then just disappeared into the distance." So I've had a lot of connections with other encounters and with other people who've had other encounters. You know, to the point where I've done quite a lot of conferences later on. I started going on the speaking circuit in the 2000s and did a few sort of conferences, especially one called Probe. Anyone in this country will remember the Probe conferences up at Blackpool. I did quite a few of those in the 2000s, which leads nicely up to how did I meet Gary Rowe with his UFO crash debris? I'm going to throw it back to you now.
The case that you're talking about in the book happened in Wales, and is it a village called, is it Llanillar? What's it like around there? I probably didn't pronounce that well, did I?
Well, I always pronounce it Llanillar with a cl. But, you know, I'm not very good on my Welsh either. What I always say is Llanillar is basically the closest village to where this crash occurred. Because, you know, in Wales, it's not hugely populated. And it's only a tiny village, and it's a tiny village in a big valley surrounded by separated farms. So this thing actually came down and hit a farm that was probably, I'd say, within 2 miles, but not as close as a mile to the village. So the closest point you can stick a pin in a map is Llanillar, which is just outside Aberystwyth in mid Wales. And that's where the crash occurred.
How did Gary find out about it? Was it Earl Evans? He was the farmer.
Yes. Well, it was two ways he found out. Gary at this point was with the Wales UFO group that was around at the time. We're talking 1983. So he had his own group running in 1983. Trying to remember what they were called. Forward to Aquarius group was his own thing that he was doing, but he had Welsh Federation of Independent Ufologists, that was it, WFIU, can remember. He had this group going, and he used to get newspaper cuttings, anything from anywhere that was sort of relevant to where he was in Wales, because, you know, he lives in Rhyl. So he got all these cuttings sent to him. And then he got this one in the Sunday Express, which basically said, you know, UFO crash at, you know, Llanillar. 23rd of January 1983, it was dated. Strange debris out of the sky. I mean, I put the full article in the book. I've got to say the book's very much show and tell, so as you probably discovered. And the newspaper article really got his attention. Because he lived in that area, he knew who to phone. So he phoned Irwell. He tracked Irwell, the farmer, down. Who was this chap who'd actually had this happen on his land, and phoned him. And Irwell's like, yeah, that's what happened. You're welcome to come down and, you know, have a poke around and see what you can find. So really, Gary got alerted to it in two ways. One, he got the article, and the next thing was when he followed it up, the farmer confirmed what had happened.
How did the farmer come across this stuff?
Apparently he came out one morning to tend his lambs, because he had lambs in fields, and the fields out there, the fields are quite significant because they are huge. They're very big. He was farming quite a large open area. And these four fields were just covered in what he describes as sheets of metal and tin foil. And there was so much of this debris that he actually assumed that a plane had crashed. So he's kind of, what do I do now? You know, what do you do when there's a plane crash? So he phoned the local police, and I think they referred him to the MOD, who he phoned, and then they sent out, you know, a crash recovery team, which actually included a third agency. Now, he doesn't know who the third agency was, He just said, you know, police turned up. Well, you can recognise what they look like. And then the army turned up, or the Air Force, and he knew what they looked like in uniforms. Then he said there was this other organisation turned up, which were sort of plain clothes, if you like. And he never really found out who they were, but they all turned up. And they said, oh, yeah, we're going to need to clear this up. We need to clean all this debris up. So basically, he left them to it at about midnight. And by the following morning, they'd cleared it all. As far as he was concerned, it had all gone. So when Gary got down there and started speaking to him, Gary was a bit sort of disheartened. He'd taken a couple of friends with him to go see what they could find. And Irwell's like, you know, you're really not going to find anything. They've done an amazing clear-up operation. But then Gary spots the fact that the woods, the neighbouring woods, has got this sort of 25-foot-wide swathe of trees cut through, facing the direction of these four fields. So they all conclude that basically what appeared to have happened is something had hit the tops of the trees, effectively smashed or shattered, and then as it was trying to escape, it scattered all this debris over the four fields, which everybody universally has said, you know, you can't lose four fields worth of, you know, outer shell and then just fly off. You know, it's just nothing we know of does that. You know, anything else would have just implanted itself in the ground, you know, engines, crews, a lot. Ba-boom. Which was really where I came in, because when they'd gone in, they'd examined the trees. They got about six pieces of debris out. They got a couple of bits of the foil and four pieces of the metal. They went back a second time. They couldn't really find any more the second time. And then the third time, all of a sudden, Irwell phones them and says, you're still welcome to come, but unfortunately, they're demolishing the woods. So Gary's like, what do you mean they're demolishing the woods? He said, well, they're cutting it all down. They're just bulldozing the woods. So Gary gets on the phone to the Forestry Commission, and the guy at the other end basically said, well, you know, we've been instructed to clear it because of wind damage, you know. And Gary's like, oh, okay. So my involvement was to see if we could find anything that had been missed, that had been embedded anywhere. But, you know, it wasn't going to happen in 2008, because that was sort of 25 years on from the crash. The woods had gone. They'd done an amazing job of clearing the site. There was literally nothing left. And the woods now at this point has turned into another field. That I don't think there was any chance archaeologically of me finding anything. But the interesting thing was the fact that Gary just said, hey, do you know what? I've still got these bits. I'm like, what do you mean? He said, well, I've got these bits we recovered in a case in you know, in my garage. Do you want to come down and have a look? I'm like, yeah, I'll come and have a look. I've got to say, though, he doesn't keep it at his house now. All the debris kept, you know, elsewhere under lock and key. He'd only brought it down to the house, really, to show me. And that's how we got on to doing the documentary side of it. As part of the investigative process.
Can you be sure that the debris was not there for a few days? Is it definite you know which night it appeared?
We've managed to work out by going backwards. The key to working out when it came down was to have a look, believe it or not, at the original notebooks of the Andrew Chapman, who wrote the newspaper article. I mean, it was in the Sunday Express on the 23rd of January. So obviously the crash happened before the 23rd of January. That's obvious. But when we were doing the DVD video documentary release back in 2008, we contacted Andrew, me and a researcher friend of mine, and we said, you know, any chance of you going back and having a look and, you know, seeing what you've got in your notebooks? And he went back and he couldn't find the source of the story. But what he did say was, he said, well, I must have been past that story to write up when we came back after the New Year break. So the story that he'd been passed, in order to make it into the newspaper for that particular issue, he'd obviously written it up 7 to 14 days prior to the 23rd. So that puts it very firmly in the first week of the new year that story got passed to him. Give or take a couple of days, you know, for the story to actually arrive at the Sunday Express. you're probably looking at the crash occurring somewhere around about the 2nd or 3rd or 4th of January. And the crash recovery team, like I say, the crash occurred one night. They then cleared it by the end of the next night. So, you know, hypothetically, if it came down on the 2nd or 3rd, you know, by the 4th or 5th, the debris was gone, you know, as far as everybody was concerned, except for the forest, you know, because the forest, clearly that was still there after the 23rd of January, because that's when Gary got the article and he went down there. So basically they'd assumed they'd done a fantastic cleanup job. Yeah, it's all sorted. That's it, done and dusted. Then this article comes out and then Gary goes down there and then he finds the extra debris. And then all of a sudden somebody in the MOD or the local area or whatever's thinking, you know, we might have missed some stuff here. So then they arranged then to have the forest cleared probably end of January, beginning of February, I would have said. Let's say beginning of February. So that's the kind of time scale you're working on. No, I think the crash occurred one night and was pretty much cleared up by the next. But it's in that first week in January 1983. We can narrow it right down to that first week.
And I suppose the farmer was out in those fields the evening before, so he'll know.
Yeah, there was no debris the evening before. I mean, farmers, you know what farmers are like. They don't really, if they've got livestock and stuff, they don't keep holidays. You know, I don't think he had a New Year's holiday. But then again, I suppose if he kept New Year's Eve with his family, like you say, if he came out and found all that debris, it does make more sense for it to be from probably the 2nd of January onwards. I don't think he remembers the exact precise date, because when I got to him, it was 25 years later, and he's never said exactly what the date was. But the first week of January is close enough. You know, that the first few days of that January, I think that's close enough. Like you said, he found it in the early hours of the morning, but it must have crashed on the, you know, 2nd, 3rd or 4th. He's found it on the 3rd, 4th or 5th. You know, certainly by the 6th or 7th, it's all done and dusted. Probably by the 5th, actually, it's done and dusted. They've come down and cleared it all. That's the kind of timescale I think we're looking at.
Was it that Gary said that you could almost trace a path through the trees where the craft had hit? So you could guess the width of the craft by looking how wide that path is?
He's never been absolutely specific, because it's always been an estimate, but in all the times I've chatted to him, he always said it's about 20 to 25 feet. So what I've tended to do is I've tended to lean slightly towards the generous and say 25 feet, because, you know, give or take sort of 5 foot, which is 2 meters. I mean, the craft could have been bigger than the bit of the craft that hit the trees, if you know what I mean. If it was kind of, you know, well, let's say saucer shaped, the bit that hit the trees was 20 to 25 feet. So I'm sort of taking that as a minimum size. So it wasn't enormous. It wasn't a massive impact. But he said you could very clearly see where it had gone through the trees. Some of the trees had fallen over. Some of them were snapped. Some had the tops cut off. There was an awful lot of scraping and bits of bark and, you know, branches and that. And then the debris then continued on just past the boundary and into the field. So he said you could very clearly see where this thing had hit the tops of the trees, and where the debris had begun to be scattered. Basically, at the cleanup operation, they probably weren't bothered about trees and branches and stuff like that. They just left those behind. So there was still a trace of this debris field beginning, but just no debris.
Yeah. Is the farmer's house close to where that all occurred? Because what I'm wondering is, if it was close and something came down like that, that was a conventional aircraft, if it was a jet or a helicopter, he would have heard it. It would have woken him up.
Well, that's the thing. When we were doing the investigation, I mean, to answer your original question, it's a very, very short walk to this particular copse and field. The farm's set back from the road. There's a field between, well, there was the copse, and then there was a field, and then there's the farm. So it's a short walk to sort of get to these fields. But it was noted when we started doing our research, you know, that nobody heard anything. Literally nobody heard anything. So the farmer didn't hear anything. The local neighbours didn't. You know, there was no sound of impact. It was like something had sort of glided in silently and broken like an egg. I mean, if you hit an egg with a hammer, all you get is a, and that's it. You get virtually no sound. This thing had fragmented and broken up. So assuming the engines are silent and the propulsion system's silent, etc., all you would have heard would have been the sound of something going through trees, maybe. But if it was going at high speed and it happened really quickly, you're talking about an instant. So, you know, middle of the night, middle of Wales, you know, you're a couple of miles out from the village. There's nobody around, you know, and it hits these trees. So it's not surprising. You know, it's not a huge, enormous mystery that nobody heard anything. That doesn't surprise me a bit, given the location. But it did surprise the farmer. And his attitude was like, you know, thank goodness it hit the trees and not me farm.
Yeah.
You know? It could have done a lot of damage if it had hit anything else, but, you know, no, it just skimmed across the top of this wooded copse.
So can you describe the wreckage? What has Gary got?
Well, like I said, if anybody wants to buy the book, I'm going to give it a quick plug.
Yeah.
All the wreckage appears in there. Everything that Gary's got, even down to a small fragment that he carries just to show people, and the fragment he gave to me that's in my keyring, that's in here, and the samples that he sent us for testing are in here as well. So literally that's the key to the book. It was deliberately show and tell. And the debris is interesting stuff. You know, if you get a hold of the book, it'll strike you just how much there's a hexagonal coating on one of these sheets of metal. The rest of the metal then is fairly plain, you know. One very large fragment has what appears to be a seam running up it, but the seam is only in these green rubbery hexagons. It's not in anything else. It doesn't go through to the metal underneath. The metal's kind of silver grey or a sort of a blackish colour, slightly burnt in patches. We actually assumed that all the metal was the same. But I'll come to that later, because one of the bits that he's got isn't the same. It's thinner. It's got like a grey resin on one side and a sort of matte green paint on the other. And it's described as non-aerodynamic, the paint. So it looks like it might be a part of an internal shell. So those two materials are actually quite different. The metal with the hexagonal stuff on, that's not necessarily the same, as we found out, as the stuff with the green paint on. And then there's a third type of metal, which is this foil. It's like a sort of, I don't know what you'd call it, aluminium bako foil. Looks like you cook your turkey in it. But it's been made into a sort of a, how can I describe it? Honeycomb. It's honeycombed. And it's all of it is massively honeycombed. You know, it's like an inch and a half, 2 inches thick. It's about, you know, maybe 3 or 4 centimetres thick, but it's all honeycombed. I'm going to stick my neck out, because I've always said this, that I think it was attached in some way to either the resin, which is on the thin metal, or to these green honeycombed patterns that we find, these rubbery things. It's got to be attached to one or the other in a sort of sandwich, I think, to make a sort of a thick but extremely lightweight shell to whatever it was that shattered. That's about the best description I can give you, really. The biggest piece, the biggest chunk, is just a little bit smaller than, say, the average computer keyboard. It's that kind of size. And the smaller pieces, they go all the way down to the size of your fingernail, but the smallest decent-sized piece recovered is probably about the size of a computer mouse mat. You know, so they're reasonable size pieces, you know, and he keeps those in a case under lock and key. If he ever takes that out, he tends to attach himself to the case as well,
yeah,
for safety.
In the scientific analysis, didn't they say that there's some kind of aluminium alloy?
Yeah, this is what I was coming to. Like I say, we automatically assumed that it was all the same material. And that assumption came from some friends that Gary had who were in the aerospace industry. He sent a piece or a couple of pieces to these friends. Obviously, he got them back. And the people in the aerospace, British Aerospace, they were, had a look at it, and they said, well, Yeah, you know, we're 99% certain this looks like something that's aluminium. It's probably duralumin. We're not sure what any of the other substances are. You know, possibly the green rubbery substance, you know, might be conductive, but they couldn't do any tests. They didn't do any proper in-depth analysis of it. They just, you know, did what they could in the 1980s and 1990s, you know, whatever was available. If we'd have wanted full analysis back then, you'd have been looking at thousands of pounds, really, to get it done by somebody in the industry. But they did note that the aluminium appeared to be what they called a pure alloy. So it wasn't something they were familiar with. And we're talking British Aerospace, so they're fairly up with the technology. And they said to Gary, oh, we'd very much like to work out how to make this, really, if we can. So that was as far as that went. Anyway, like you say, we've had it retested. We sent one sample to Australia and we sent one sample to America. Now, the Australians then, they really quite confidently sent this report back and said, yeah, you know, this is aluminium foam. So me and Gary are like, foam? Aluminium foam, what is that? Well, apparently it's a substance that's made, you mix several chemicals together and it causes this foam that hardens at room temperature to appear, and it's made of aluminium and you can make stuff out of it. They said quite confidently, they said, oh yeah, and on one side we have this resinous glue. We're not sure what the resin's made of, but we think it's this particular type of American adhesive. And they named it, so it's this American glue. So, you know, it's nothing unusual. It's just a modern day form, you know, of aluminium, etc. Well, my first reaction was, I don't think anybody had aluminium foam in the late 70s, early 80s. That was my first reaction when we got that report back, because that came back first. But they did say it's not duralumin. Duralumin is a trade name for, you know, various other different types of aluminiums. It's not duralumin. So that kind of put the cat among the pigeons. So we're all like, okay, they got the aluminium bit right. And then we got the American one back. And the American test came back. And at this point, I'm thinking, oh, they're just going to say, you know, yeah, we know exactly what this is because it's got American glue on it. Anyway, the test comes back. The gist of the test is, we have absolutely no idea what this is at all. It actually came back as no match to standard chemistry. And the principal content of the metallic part of it, 94.6%, is lanthanum. Now, lanthanum is an exotic metal. It's a very strange one indeed. It's quite common. It's knocking around all over the place, but it costs a fortune to produce. It is an incredibly expensive metal to produce. And that's what this stuff with the hexagons on is. So the thin stuff with the green paint and the resin on is foam aluminium. And then the slightly thicker stuff with the hexagonal pattern on it, the weird hexagonal pattern, is lanthanum. So, and it's not just any old lanthanum. It's a non-standard chemistry formula of other metals as well mixed in. So the Americans were just completely blown away by this. They're like, we have no idea, you know. It distorts when we try to photograph it, you know, and various other problems with it. It's just really odd. Exotic metal. So then I sort of, in the book, I put all three of those things together. And so you've got an aluminium substance that British Aerospace didn't know really what it was. And that's as far as they went, but certainly it shouldn't exist at that point. Then you've got some kind of foam aluminium. And I think basically the Australians had no idea what the glue is because the Americans didn't identify the glue. So they didn't really know what, you know, where the substances were coming from. So I don't think it's an American glue unless it's been back engineered, but that's another question you no doubt want to ask me about. And then the lanthanum bit, that's just bonkers. If you built, you know, an aeroplane, a flying craft, you know, a drone or a disc that was 25 foot wide, it's going to cost billions of dollars to extract that amount of metal to make that function. And that certainly did not exist at the beginning of the 1980s. You know, yeah, Duralumin goes all the way back to, you know, the Zeppelins back in the early 1900s before the First World War. But I'm not sure if that wasn't a bit of a, you know, smoke and mirrors distraction, to be honest. I think, you know, if British Aerospace did know what it was, I don't think they would have told Gary. But I think Gary's bright enough, clever enough to know that it's plausibly, you know, plausibly aluminium. So that's the route they went down. So they, I think they told Gary what they could, you know, what they were allowed to tell him. And that's really where we came down with in terms of making decisions based on the analysis. But what I tend to do is I tend to avoid some of those issues in the book because I'd rather people actually looked at the two reports and form their own conclusions from that. That's sort of where I was going with the book. You know, at the end of the day, my archaeological training, you know, leads me to not draw too many conclusions because I know you can go, you know, quite wrong by making assumptions. But yeah, wow, you know, we thought we were going to solve the mystery with the analysis and we've actually made it worse.
And didn't Gary say that he got a visit from some unmarked black cars and things?
Yeah, when I was doing the, I mean, he doesn't mind me saying this and he didn't mind me putting it in the book. But we didn't do it on camera. When we actually, I mean, the documentary's out there, by the way. You can go and find it. I've just put the director's fully HD copy of it back up. So that's out on YouTube. So if anyone comes and finds me on Facebook, the link's on there. Or they could just put Europe's Roswell into YouTube and it'll come up. A fabulous company called Drake Michigan is putting up all my back catalogue. So that's just gone up. But when we were doing that documentary and we were filming all of the interviews, Gary didn't want to go on camera to tell the story. Now, obviously, it's, what, 40 years now, so he doesn't mind me telling it now. Yeah, he had a knock on the door, and when he opened the door, I mean, his place is really hard to find. I'm just going to leave it at that, because he obviously doesn't want people invading him. But anyway, he opened the door and looked out, and there's a couple of guys, black suits, you know, black ties, fairly incomprehensible passes, dark glasses, clearly the men in black, and a couple of unmarked sort of, you know, SUV-type vehicles with no number plates. And he's sort of, yes, can I help you? You know, and these guys are like, yeah, we've come because we want our material back. So Gary just looked them in the eye, basically, and he just said, well, he said, you're a bit late. And they said, oh, what do you mean? He said, well, do you know, since I've found this material, he said, I've broken some of it up into little tiny key rings. He said, I think there's probably about 100 of these little key rings. And he said, I've distributed them. So the press has got some, the media's got some. He said, people in ufology have got some. He said, you know, so there's quite a few of these key rings knocking around. He said, so you're too late. He said, so I'll do your deal. He said, if you leave my stuff alone, the stuff I've got in my case, and, you know, you just leave me to it, I will not tell anybody to go public. At which point these guys apparently just mumbled something to each other and nodded to Gary and disappeared off out of his, you know, street in these SUVs. And that was the last he saw of them. He doesn't think they were aliens. He thinks they were human beings. You know, they're not nothing odd. Apart from the fact that they didn't really identify themselves. He said to me in the conversation, he said, they just looked military. That's all he said, which fits the description of what other people have had happen, you know. But, you know, 10 out of 10 to Gary for coming up with that one. You know, once the material's out and there's a load of people got them, I mean, back then in the, you know, 1980s, you could phone your mates, you know, just phone them up and just go, hey, you know, let rip, release it, you know, let the cat out of the bag. So I don't suppose there was anything they could do, you know. Gary had been quite clever back then in the way he dealt with it. There is a sort of a postscript to this, though. I keep mentioning the documentary that we did in 2008. I did it for quite a big company in America, Reality Films, and it was released on DVD, and eventually I think it found its way onto pay-to-view somewhere. But when it first came out, I thought, oh yeah, this is really gonna, you know, rock the world. This is gonna, you know, gonna be met with wide acclaim, and people are gonna really be interested, and you know, and the story's gonna break, and it just didn't happen. You know, one US radio station, I think, picked up on it, and then they never followed through. They never actually followed through with the interview. It just went deadly flat. It was like we hadn't done it, you know. So I think there was a cover-up. I think there was a concerted effort to try and push this right down as far as they could, you know, to play it down on quite a large scale, because it really didn't take off. Maybe if the glue on that piece we sent to Australia, maybe if the glue's American, maybe America wasn't the right place to go to release the DVD. Maybe they really did want to cover something up. But yeah, that's sort of where the 2008 episode ended, I suppose.
And with the wreckage, I just want to check. There wasn't really any sign that it was there was any great heat there. It's not like it could have been something that came down like a satellite and it just burnt up in the atmosphere and came down that way.
Well, I can guarantee at the site itself, the only damage to anything was the top of the trees. So there's no crater, no burning, nothing looked like it had blown up or exploded on the ground, unless there was some kind of air burst, which we have speculated. We speculate that in the documentary, that maybe it's exploded above the ground, but it still flew off. You know, whatever substantial thing it was, it disappeared. It just vanished. So the actual evidence on the ground doesn't really match anything like a satellite. The sample the Australians got didn't show any signs of burning or melting or buckling or damaging. So that's what we're now starting to think is perhaps the internal shell. But then the other stuff with the hexagons on, you can clearly see that the largest panel looks like it's got some burning damage on it. And the Americans, when they did their analysis, they said, there's some kind of burning, buckling or twisting on this. But we've always said that, you know, because of the shape of the metal, because it's either concave or convex, depending on where it came from, we've always said it maybe imploded or exploded from whatever craft it was attached to. So, you know, heat damage is by no means out of the question, but not impact damage in a sense. You know, the impact in the title of the book actually is, I should qualify that, is the impact on the trees. You know, it didn't hit anything any harder than trees, but I think it picked a fight and lost.
So were there other UFO sightings around that time in that area, maybe in the weeks or months?
Yes. I mean, subsequent to doing the documentary, I've sort of carried on, if you like. I haven't, it doesn't suddenly come to an end. I've not suddenly sort of stopped looking into this. And I've contacted a few folks, you know, chatted to quite a lot of people in Wales again, revisited the whole thing with Gary, et cetera. And it's very clear, certainly in the 1990s, that there was a huge amount of activity around sort of Cardigan Bay and around the valleys. I mean, if you go back way, way back, the first sort of real incidents of anything else happening would be the Berwyn Mountain incident, which incidentally, this is not that. This has got nothing to do, this is not connected in any way to the Berwyn Mountain incident. Well, that's back in the 1970s. But then through the 80s and the 90s, 1980s, clearly I saw something coming across the Wirral. So did other people. And then there were other sightings then going back further into Wales at that time by various people. We could be here a long time if I go through all of them. Gary himself then had some sightings as well in the 80s and 90s. So there's kind of a sort of a Welsh triangle, if you like, whereby things sort of go vertically upwards from Cardigan Bay, but also diagonally across. And then when you join those two lines together, they join up sort of across the top of North Wales and up the Mersey Valley, you know, into Derbyshire and Manchester and the lower parts of Lancashire. There seems to be this enormous triangle. But if you fly low enough, you can go below the radar. There are areas there where you could fly craft and stay sort of off the radar. So, yeah, there has been other things, you know. I met a lady at a conference, and she said, oh, you know, I've got to tell you something about this this Europe's Roswell thing. And I said, oh, what's that? She said, well, I was a student, and I was studying art, and I was in Aberystwyth. And she said, I'm pretty sure it was, give or take a few days, at the beginning of 1983. And she said, I was, I got up one morning, opened the curtains. It was in the early morning, she said, and I could see this light coming up out of the sea in Cardigan Bay. And she said, oh, I thought, hey, that's really creepy. She said, it looks a bit like a, you know, a UFO thing. And she happened to have a camera handy. And she said, this thing broke the water, flew up into the air, and she managed to get a photo of it. Now, the downside is, I said, you know, please send me a copy of that photo. You know, I gave her emails, I gave her phone numbers, I gave her all my details, and she never got back in touch with me. So I never got the photo. But those lights are not unusual, because the Coast Guard in Cardigan Bay apparently has the MOD telephone number in case they spot anything doing the same kind of thing. So it's not unknown. It's not unknown for things to be zipping around, you know, in that sort of area, you know, being unidentified.
What was the Berwyn Mountain incident? Yeah, what happened there?
Oh, I can't remember exactly when it was, but it's 1970s. I think it's fairly early 1970s. And there's a town called, I think it's over Bala. It's over that way. It's this mountain, and basically people saw all these lights and things on the mountain and started phoning in and reporting them. And then somebody saw, I think it was either a fire engine or a crash recovery or a helicopter or something like that. And then they started phoning that in. And then the people saw this bright, really bright light, and they thought it was UFOs. And then it turned into a UFO crash. It's a very, very well investigated incident. It really has been sort of done to death. And it's a clear case of something that was perhaps logical ballooning and getting out of hand, because there was sound involved with this, as well as sight and lights and all sorts of stuff going on. And it kind of ballooned, and then eventually it became this official, oh, you know, UFOs crashed on Berwyn, sent up a recovery crew, this, that and the other. And then once it started being investigated, because there's been some really serious investigations done with the Berwyn one, there were people lost on the mountain that night, hikers or whatever, hitchhikers, that had to be rescued. And that kind of ruled out the helicopter. And I think to some extent they've ruled out the fire engine as well, because I think it turned out not to be a fire engine. So when you actually start knocking down the bits of evidence piece by piece, they don't really stand up to scrutiny. I know it made it all the way to Ancient Aliens, and I know they had witnesses and lots of other things to do with the Berwyn Mountain incident. But generally speaking, the serious UFO community, I think, have sort of put that one to bed, you know, because it was investigated. And there are two, like I say, two schools of thought on it, one that it was real and one that it wasn't. As a serious investigator, I tend to lean more towards that one not being quite what it appeared to be. That's me being as generous as I can be, I suppose. But that, in essence, that's the gist of the Berwyn Mountain. It's on the Berwyn Mountains. They're the mountain range in North Wales. And that we're sort of in a different area, because we're south of Snowdonia on the coast. So there's quite a lot of mileage between the two incidents. Don't know if they're related, if there genuinely was some activity of some kind there, you know, maybe. But I'm sort of dealing very specifically with a case that occurred in the 80s with evidence here, really. The thing that frustrates me is whenever we get in contact with anybody, like the Australians made a complete pig's ear of it, because they tried to work out exactly what we were talking about. They thought it was the Berwyn Mountain incident. So the emails and the introduction to their report is just completely wrong. The Americans were a bit better at it. They didn't mess up the introduction, but they got a few of the factual bits wrong. So when we came to actually put the final analysis in the book, I left the introductions off because they were wrong. And you've got the introduction anyway, because you've got the book. So, you know, clearly they'd got on the internet and just dragged the story off the web. So they'd got it really badly mixed up and badly confused, which didn't really make any difference to the analysis, I'm glad to say.
Well, thanks a lot for coming on the podcast. The book is Europe's Roswell, 40 Years Since Impact. People can get that on Amazon, and they can see the DVD that's on YouTube now.
Yes, that's called Europe's Roswell as well. So it's easy enough to find. The full director's cut's on there. So, yeah, that's where to go for that. You might find DVD hard copies somewhere. There might still be some copies knocking around out there that you can pick up on Amazon, but they'll be collector's items by now.
Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast. It's been great.
Fantastic. Thank you for having me.
And that was an interview with Mark Olley about his book, Europe's Roswell, 40 Years Since Impact. A great way to support the podcast is to sign up to Patreon, where you can hear the extended version of this episode. Just go to patreon.com/AlienUFOPodcast. If you join the $2 a month tier, you get an extended episode every month. If you join the $5 a month tier, you'll have access to an extended episode every week. And when you sign up, you get access to the episodes in the back catalogue, and they are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. And please check out my other podcast. It's called Past Lives Podcast. There are over 290 episodes. On Past Lives Podcast, I look into evidence of the afterlife, such as near-death experiences, children with past life memories, mediumship, deathbed visions, and other phenomena. I also release an extra episode of Past Lives Podcast every Thursday called Paranormal Stories. And I've put together designs for Alien UFO Podcast t-shirts. And if you want to buy one, you can go to the t-shirts tab on my website, which is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. And the link is in the show notes. And in my work as a clinical hypnotherapist, I take people through past life regression. When you book a past life regression hypnosis session with me and you've signed up to Patreon, you get a 25% discount. And I'm offering a free consultation call, which could be booked on my website. My Instagram is the Past Lives Podcast with an underscore between each word. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening. They must have been quite substantial clear up going all through the night that they thought it was that important if it's over four fields.
Yeah. I mean, I've been up there. I'm trying to estimate how big the fields were. Let's say each field is about the size of a...